I had an awesome conversation with Rand Fishkin, the founder of Moz, and now the founder of SparkToro and Snack Bar Studio. But aside from being a founder, Rand is also an author. He wrote a book called Lost and Founder. This was like 6 years ago, and I remember reading this book. It's a rare, rare book in the startup world because he's super transparent about what it was like to be the founder and CEO of a venture-backed startup. He goes through all the ins and outs and ultimately becomes kind of jaded, frankly, about VC, which is why his new company, SparkToro, is totally different. It's just three employees. They do $2 million a year in revenue. They grow steadily year over year, and they're very profitable. And so on this show, we've mainly interviewed founders of unicorns that have gone on to be like billion-dollar plus companies, which is certainly one path. The reality is venture capital is the path for maybe 5% or so of startups. Yeah, if you want to build the next Amazon, you probably have to go down the VC route. But if you want to make like even a few million dollars a year, in fact, if you want to make $10 million through, let's say, an exit event, you actually are more likely to get there through a bootstrapped company. And in this episode, we go really, really deep on what it's like to start and build a bootstrapped, profitable company and why you don't really need VCs like me to succeed. Welcome to the Product Market Fit Show, brought to you by Mistral, a seed stage firm based in Canada. I'm Pablo. I'm a founder turned VC. My goal is to help early stage founders like you find product market fit. You cost me a lot of money, and I'll tell you exactly how. It's because I have a really close friend who, so I'm on the venture side now, and I have a really close friend who I think actually was the one who referred your book to me. And he was like, man, I read this book, like, this is what I'm going to do, like, screw the VC stuff, whatever. And then he like totally hit it, like his company just, and I was like, please let me invest, please. Like, no, we just want bootstrap. Ended up raising, but once they were like, you know, 10 million plus AR sort of thing. And so anyways, I think I would have gone in if it wasn't for your book, dude.
I mean, I think there's something wonderful for founders about sort of recapturing some of the power dynamic in an investor environment, right? Because capital has just 100-to-1 all the power in every conversation, in every part of society and politics and economics, and being able to, you know, give labor back like even a shred of that is something I'd be really proud to say, you know, that my career could have helped with. And that's not, I don't think that people who are in these companies or these investment firms are bad people. I don't think they have bad intent, but I think their incentive structure is such that you're going to, by your very nature, right, by your existence, harm a lot of small and startup companies in exchange for a very small number of winners. And that's not an environment I'm excited to create or participate in. You know, my whole goal for the startup world is, how do we make more companies that are profitable long term, even if they stay very small and they survive, and eventually maybe they become something bigger than that, or maybe they don't, and they're just, you know, wonderful experiences for the few people who work there and the customers that they've got and the environment that they're in. I think a diverse economy is far preferable to a concentrated wealth and power economy. And obviously, you know, the United States has been moving in the opposite direction for a long time. That's pretty concerning.
But I think, you know, you mentioned like it's not about good versus evil. And I think that's totally right. Like, I think what you're really doing is opening the eyes, because the problems really tend to happen when somebody goes into it with their eyes not wide open and not really understanding like what they've gone themselves into it. And even myself, like when I started my last startup, Gymtrack, I didn't know. I mean, you just don't know what you don't know, right? And part of it, like, you have to go through it, take the punches to the face. But obviously, books like yours and just content that is open and like actually talks through like the ups and the downs helps. It can help a lot. And on both sides, right? Because frankly, like, and I've said this to founders, like, if you don't want to go for the big, like the big, big outcome and forego everything else, maybe you don't want to take VC, or you certainly don't want to take too much VC, because it's bad for everybody, right? Like, you want to only do it when it's fully aligned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a big psychological and sort of cultural challenge around this, which is, I don't think any single investor or media personality or founder is responsible for this. But overall, the last 25 years have definitely created an environment where almost every founder feels like, if I'm not raising lots of money and trying to become the billion-dollar unicorn, then I am not as good of an entrepreneur. I'm not as impressive of a person. I'm not as worthy of professional sort of admiration and happiness and feeling accomplished and feeling like I'm enough. That is a serious problem, and it is dumb as hell, right?
Maybe let's start with kind of the origin story of Moz. You know, you were kind of running, you were in the SEO game already. You were doing more of a services type business. How did you transition that into what ultimately became Moz, kind of the venture-backed startup that became very well known, attracted a lot of venture capital, and went on to be acquired?
Let's see. I dropped out of college in 2001 and started building websites, essentially doing web design for local small Seattle businesses, alongside my mom, Jillian, who had been running a small business marketing and advertising consultancy, you know, sort of one woman shop here in Seattle for 20 years before that. So interestingly, you know, if you look at the kind of like foundation of what became Moz, the company started in 1981, technically, right? So that business kind of transitioned into a web design development business, which was failing miserably, racked up a ton of debt, did not do well. And then we couldn't pay our SEO subcontractors. And so we had a conversation. It was like, Rand, you need to learn to do SEO and do that because we really need that money. And we promised it to them, but we can't afford to pay these, you know, these contractors. So dove into SEO and found it extremely frustrating and very secretive, you know, that both the industry and the search engines at the time.
What year was this?
2002, 2003, 2004.
Yeah, okay. Early days.
Around that era. So, you know, Google was the most popular search engine by 2004, but MSN, Lycos, Alta Vista, InfoC, Cotbot, MSN Search, you know, Ask Jeeves, like they were all still around. And so, you know, trying to do all this stuff. I think, in fact, that one of the big catalysts for me trying to kind of reverse engineer and publicize more about how search engines worked and start this website at the time called SEO Moz, I think that started in 2003, was my frustration with the fact that I had gotten a lot of our clients ranking on most of the other search engines, Yahoo and MSN and Ask, but not Google. Huh. And I was like, what is Google doing? Something's weird, something's different, something's wrong. They don't like the same things. They seem to have some other algorithm at play.
Was the other stuff just, and this is kind of historical at this point, but was it just like keyword density? Like I remember there were like keyword clouds and that's weird things back then.
Most of the keyword density stuff ended by the end of the 90s.
Okay.
But so links were a huge part of search engine rankings in the early 2000s. Keyword usage still mattered, but it was quite simplistic compared to where it is today. And there wasn't a lot of user behavior that went into it. Which now today dominates most algorithms, right? Brand dominates a lot of algorithms today. So would have been really hard to try and rank anything in today's environment. But we struggled with Google quite a bit, and I started publishing on SEO Moz. It was originally on a different domain, but then moved it to the SEOMoz.org domain. And that website, you know, my goal was like, I'm going to be like the other Mozes. I don't know if, Pablo, you remember the early 2000s, but there was like a site called DMoz, which was the Open Directory project. There was a site called ChefMoz that was like open recipes. There was a site called MapMoz that was open geography information. Huh. There were all these different Moz.
The only
websites.
Moz I know, I think, is Mozilla.
Mozilla was one of them as well. So,
okay.
So I think the only two that kind of survived that long era were Mozilla and Moz, which is funny. Basically, I started publishing there, and we earned quite an audience, and that sent us some consulting business for SEO, which is what the business transitioned into. So it went from web design fully over to SEO. And then in 2007, we had built some software that we were using internally for ourselves to try and like make our processes easier and better. Essentially, I really wanted to share that with our community, all these people who were reading the blog. This was sort of it wasn't pre-social media, but it was pre-popular Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, all that kind of stuff. And so I convinced our developer, Matt, to basically build a PayPal paywall on top of the software that we had behind the scenes. We launched that at the start of 2007. And by the middle of that year, it was already doing more revenue than the consulting business. And that is not because the software was great. I don't think no one would say it had product market fit. Like it was crappy little shitty tools that, you know, were barely better than doing it manually. But everyone who was doing SEO was reading our blog. Mm-hmm. So we had the audience, and that audience first approach was just incredibly powerful, right? Because they knew us, they liked us, they trusted us. So when we published some software, they were like, oh yeah, I can do the same processes that the Moz folks have been teaching me and use their software to make some of them easier and faster. And there weren't a lot of, you know, web cloud-based solutions for doing SEO. There was virtually no software as a service in that field at all. And Moz took off. So by the, I think we did about $800,000 of revenue that year, maybe a little bit more. And more than half of that, like $450,000 of that, was the software. And that's when Ignition Partners and Curious Office came in and invested at $1.1 million. The TechCrunch and Wikipedia numbers are wrong. I have tried to convince them to change them, but they're like, we can't trust you. You're not a credible source.
Who are you? Right. You're not relevant to this. You just made the company.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we raised $1.1 million. Thankfully, the cap table and like all the legal docs represent this accurately. And then basically off to the races, right? We hired a couple of engineers that I knew through my wife, Geraldine. She'd gone to school with this really smart guy named Ben, and they built a link index of the web over the next year. And at the end of 2008, we launched that. It was originally called Linkscape. I think the product inside Moz is now called, I'm not sure what they call it, but it essentially crawls the web and shows all the links that point to all the other sites on the web, similar to how Google does it on their backend. And of course, this was like a big innovation and challenging product to build at the time, expensive product to build. Although, you know, if you think about $1.1 million in today's world, you're like, what? That's no money at all.
By the way, like back then at that point, did you understand what you were getting into? Like, did you kind of have this idea of like, wow, this is really taking off. Let's go create a unicorn. Let's raise some money. Or was it just kind of like one step in front of the other? Oh, they're offering me money. Bit of a no-brainer. Like, let's take it.
I'm very grateful. I don't think the term unicorn even existed. Like, okay. No one had used it yet. Right. There wasn't a focus on that. There was, you know, it was the venture capital world kind of that was left over from the late 90s. And so the idea was, you know, hey, build something big. Eventually, you're going to sell it or you're going to IPO. But there wasn't a focus on an exact amount. I think a billion-dollar startup still felt semi-ridiculous to most people, which was nice.
It probably should. Yeah, like that.
Yeah, as it should. As it should. Even a $100 million startup should feel ridiculous to most people because the odds of that happening are so vanishingly slim. And it's weird to me that we all talk about this thing that's less likely than most lottery wins. So I don't totally love it. But anyway, so Moz, you know, basically from whatever, 06 to 2014, doubles year over year, every year. Hmm. Like it's just dun, 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 dun. And so gets to...
close to what? Yeah, like 50 million-ish?
When I left, it got to like a little over 30 million in 2014. And then essentially growth was slowing, got to like 40 million, maybe the next year, a couple years later, and eventually got to 50. Okay. But it was at that point, it was growing, you know, sub 10% year over year. So it really plateaued. In 2014, I had a deep bout with depression and stepped down as CEO and promoted my longtime chief operating officer to the role. And Moz was, I mean, I say struggling, like it wasn't really, I was very upset that we were only growing 50% year over year at that point, either 13 or 14 had slowed to like 50%. And that was, you know, very upsetting to me. I remember Brad Feld, who had come in as our investor from Foundry Group, was like, you're the best performing company in our portfolio. Like, it's okay. You're doing great, man.
Yeah. I mean, 50% of those numbers is meaningful revenue growth for sure.
But we had entered the era of the unicorn, right? So, and we had raised another $18 million in 2012, so now we are really obligated to how do we get to $100 million in revenue growing at 20% with 80% plus margins, right? That was like our goal. And the margins were quite high. I think they were even higher than 80%, which is great gross margins, but, the growth rate was slowing, and it was this like, nope, growth rate slowed too early. And so there were two competing opinions inside the business. One from most of the board and the new CEO was that SEO was tapped out. There basically wasn't enough of a market in SEO to build a $100 million a year company. And the other opinion, which was shared by myself and some other people, mostly lower down in the company and on the SEO side of things, was SEO is an absolutely huge market, but we're getting our lunch eaten by these other new competitors, and we need to start building better features and making the software more useful and updating the UI and all that kind of stuff.
What were some of the big competitors coming up at that point?
The two big ones were SEMrush and Ahrefs, but there were another 10 or 20 software as a service businesses that were all sort of, you know, nipping at heels and getting to the $5 to $10 million revenue size. But SEMrush, I think in maybe it was 2017, 18, somewhere around there, I think they went public and their numbers showed, you know, like $120 million in revenue a year, and they're way over that now.
Yeah, what are they now? I'm just looking at a market cap, $2 billion company. There you go. So that was the opportunity.
If I had been more persuasive and a sort of better CEO and remained CEO and like done a great job, I think Moz could have been in that position or a similar position, right? Certainly in 2013, for example, if you were to survey 10,000 SEOs and say, what software do you use and what do you recommend most? Moz would have been number one. And by 2018, 5 years later, Moz was probably number three. And today, I don't even know if it's number five.
What do you think about, I mean, in your case, like you had your own personal reasons for, let's say, moving away from being CEO. Like now you've had like enough time to just think about all that, maybe in not necessarily in your case, but more generally, what was it like to not be the CEO of the company you founded, right? And I say that as someone who, we went through something similar, Gymtrack. I was COO, so I wasn't CEO, but I co-founded it with my co-founder who was CEO. And at one point we transitioned, brought in a professional CEO. And I know for him, it was almost impossible. He was just like, I can't. He ended up leaving like quickly. I was fine because I was already used to that role. But it's like, how do you go from just, you have the final say, you know, every time, and sure, you delegate and all these sort of things to, holy crap, I don't have that anymore. Like, it's tough.
You know, I remember having some conversations with the CEO after I had stepped down and was like, hey, if the company were doing great and you were overruling my decisions, I think I'd be like, well, hey, you know, she's crushing it, doing a great job. So I'll sit back and enjoy the ride. And if we were sort of on the same page and she were like listening to me and doing the things that we agreed were the best and the company wasn't doing well, I'd be like, well, all right, let's put our heads together and keep hammering away at this and try and come up with something. But the combination of that's feeling tough, not listened to and poor performance, oh, that is just, you know, emotional and psychological killer. So that really sucked. I think it sucked for her too. I think she had a terrible time. I don't envy her experience either. I don't think that was fun for anybody. So in 2018, I left Moz. I started, well, okay, opinions vary, Pablo. One kind to Rand interpretation is he was frustrated and felt like he wasn't contributing as much as he could. And so he left to go start another
graciously
company.
Yeah.
Yes. And another interpretation is the leadership of that company was sick and tired of his bullshit and right, wanted him gone.
Walked you to the door and you took that last step. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I wrote in the blog post that I wrote about my departure, which was like the next morning on SparkToro's website, which I had started that night, that post said, on a scale of 0 to 10, where 0 is, you know, escorted out of the building by security and 10 is like everybody hugs and it's tears and happiness and congratulations, my departure was like a 4.
That's common. I think there's few cases. I mean, like Google is one where they actually, you know, very much graciously gave it off to Eric Schmidt or whatever. But in general, CEO goes from CEO to not CEO. You know, again, the company has to do, I mean, Google did exceptionally well. So I think everybody was pretty happy with that outcome. But yeah, I think in most cases, it looks more like the Gymtrack or like what happened at Moz, where it's, you know, yeah, a 3 to 5 out of 10.
Messy,
that's
ugly.
Right.
You know, I think the heartbreaking thing about a lot of it is, you know, Geraldine and I, my wife and I, have this conversation, have had it a couple of times where we're like, gosh, you know, if we could go back in time and Moz failed completely, like it just, you know, kind of went to 0, it never sold, didn't become worth anything, but all those relationships were preserved. Like everybody had stayed on the same page, fighting the good fight together, going down with the ship together, you know, and we were still going out to dinners together and looking after each other's kids and going on vacations and being like, hey, you know, we tried our best and I still love you. I would take that deal.
Huh.
I would take that deal in a heartbeat.
Mall's worked out for you, I would think, as a shareholder.
Yes. And I think for Geraldine and I alone, nobody else.
I see.
So we, you know, I had done over the years, I had done an intentional sort of, you know, tough negotiating job of retaining a tremendous amount of my shares in the company. So I think at the end of the company's life, I still own, you know, Geraldine and I had 18% of the company, 17%, something like that, which is very, very high for a founder, especially a founder who's no longer at the business. But when the company sold, a ton of people's shares were underwater. They lost money working at the company, which pisses me off so badly. I want to say every swear that there is, right?
Because like, they had what, options that were worthless or RSUs that they bought into or something? Okay.
Exactly, which you have to pay taxes on those options when you execute them. And then if the money is not worth anything, like you technically get the credit, I guess, towards future tax payments.
Sure, the tax laws of...
yeah, great. Really, yeah. Like, wow, I prepaid 40 grand worth of taxes. Like, I'm so glad I worked at that company. You know, insane bullshit. And the reason that it's structured that way is to benefit investors, right? Because most people don't execute their RSUs, which goes back into the pot, which means investors and preferred shareholders get a bigger stake, you know, at the end of the company's life. And so, you know, our investors... I don't think our later stage investors even made 2x on their money, maybe just barely, which of course is not, you know, that doesn't beat the market rate of returns all.
Right.
And, you know, for Geraldine and I, like we got a giant check, but it was certainly a less giant check than the offers we had received for the company 4 years before and 5 years before and 6 years before and all that kind of stuff, right? So it was an outstanding, life-changing amount of money outcome, but certainly lower than what we could have done years earlier.
Sure.
Which really sucks. And, you know, we ended up writing dozens of personal checks to people who'd been screwed at the company. I say that not to brag, but because I think any founder who does well out of their business should make sure that all of their employees are taken care of. And if I can shame you into feeling terrible about taking your $10 million and being like, well, it's all mine. Like, yeah, legally and technically, it is all yours. And if you didn't write some checks to cover people who you know contributed to that success and made you all that money, you're a bad person and you should feel bad. The gift tax limit, Pablo, is high. Like Geraldine and I were able to, under the gift tax limit, write checks of $36,000 to a ton of people.
Huh. Okay. Well, it's good to know. Founders, like exited founders that are listening.
Go take care of the people who made you rich.
That's right. But, you know, the other thing that comes out of that to me is like maybe, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago, I did a podcast with another founder friend of mine, and he had this like talking about the venture, not venture kind of debate, right? He made $10 million off his startup. It was a $30 million exit. It was bootstrap. I mean, at one point he raised $2 million, but it was like way later. And I don't know that enough people realize like just where you actually need to get a venture backed startup to. And I'm on the VC side. That's the only people I can work with, right? But like just understand like where you really need to get to. You talked about this in your book, in order for you to be able to make, say, $10 million in actual cash versus like if you own 50% of a $20 million business, which to be clear, is not easy, but you can bootstrap over a decade, let's say, to something that gets you there, you might be better off. Or at least as well off with a lot less stress, right?
I'm going to say this. The venture environment is a little bit less so right now because of the sort of end of cheap money era. But
yes,
you know, for the 17 years that I was in it, it was growth at all costs. And all costs means a lot of costs, right? It means personal health and happiness. It means relationships. It means sacrificing sort of profitability and a safety net for growth. It means taking low probability bets like, hey, SEO isn't big enough. We should go expand to a bunch of other marketing channels, you know, the strategy that Moz pursued, rather than, hey, we have this great business. Let's see if we can keep growing that or if that field keeps growing and double down on this thing that is clearly workable. And it also means a lot of uncomfortable, very challenging personal and professional growth. So I had 200 plus employees at the end of my tenure and I hated it. I don't enjoy politics and challenges that come from running a large team. I don't get value or joy from sort of resolving interpersonal issues or intra-team issues or inter-team challenges.
That's true for most founders. Most founders actually don't want to be managers, which is what you have to be. Like, you cross a certain amount of people and you're more of a manager and you're dealing with the problems you're mentioning. You're not building, right? Which is what most founders like to do.
You know, so at the two companies I run now, so SparkToro has three people, myself, Casey, our CTO, and Amanda, our VP marketing. And, you know, it's small, it's under $2 million ARR, but it's also very profitable, extremely profitable, very beautiful business. And we have tons of fun. You know, Pablo, last night we did like we launched our new version of SparkToro that we've been working on for a year. It's been, you know, a relatively stressful process. But also during that time, Amanda had her second kid and took like, you know, 6 months off and of parental leave, which is, you know, that's like one third of all of our labor gone, right? Casey and I regularly still try and work 32 hour weeks. We take lots of vacations and time off for other things. I obviously run another company, right? So I'm busy doing that. At Snack Bar, Snack Bar Studio, there's five of us, all founders. We all sort of work independently all over the globe. I probably spend only 10 hours a week on that business. And it is just an absolute joy. The team got together at a farmhouse in on the border between Lazio and Umbria in Italy last month and had an outstanding time and ate at a bunch of fancy restaurants and, you know, cooked for each other and found out our game designer is like a pianist. And yeah, just, you know, awesome stuff. And the quality of life that you can have with these kinds of businesses is so much better. And you know what's really beautiful to me is you are doing work that I think really, really is about what you want to do, who you want to help, where you want to direct your efforts.
I got to ask some questions on, because I think that's super interesting. First of all, like, how much was like the whole Basecamp 37 Signals? Like, was that an inspiration for the way you're kind of setting things up now, let's say it's SparkToro?
Oh, interesting. You know, there was a time when I was sort of had a very high opinion of those guys, I think like in the mid 2000s.
Because I remember they put out a book called Rework. I don't remember when I read it, but it was like this anti-VC and anti like really, which was like just, hey, the debate is all over here. Like, here's this other thing we're doing, by the way, and it's working. And so that was refreshing.
I would say for me, it was a different one. There's a book called Small Giants.
Okay.
And I read that book. It has a bunch of different examples. I'd urge folks to check it out. I think it's a great sort of community. And it's called, I think the subtitle is Companies That Choose to Be Great Instead of Big.
Well, I'll put that in the show notes. I guess... So let's do some kind of quick, because just want to dive into this SparkToro thing. I don't know how much you're comfortable sharing, but my quick math in the back of my head kind of says, okay, there's four of you. I don't know if you're all like, you know, 25% owners, three of you SparkToro. Is that right? Okay. So I'm thinking, okay, like you each draw, I don't know, $200,000 to $300,000 salary, and you still have like $1 million in let's say net profit, because I'm sure it's a super high gross margin business. Is that like roughly back the envelope about right?
It's close. Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty close to accurate. Good guessing there.
So that, you know, that sounds like appealing, and you work 30 to 40 hours a week. So like, that sounds appealing to, I think, anybody listening. Here's the first question that comes to me is, and you hear this, like with the people I work with, right, which are founders that are into this VC game, it's like, man, if we don't hire more people, if we don't build faster, like we're not going to compete. Like, how could you possibly compete with three people? Tomorrow, somebody sees the opportunity, they raise $2 million, they hire 10, 15. When they crush you?
I mean, this is what's great. I remember with Moz, like over the years, we'd look at competitors who got venture funding and we'd be like, oh no, oh no. And then of course the venture odds came into play and it was like, oh no, they all die, right? Until one of them, Semrush, had success, but even they raised money very late, sort of after they had built a nearly Moz-sized business bootstrapping. Ahrefs is entirely bootstrapped, never fundraised. They're well over 100 million in revenue as well, right? So, I mean, the frustrating part of that, you know, that whole journey is like, oh my God, that ecosystem could support multiple $100 million plus businesses, and Moz just sort of took its eye off the ball at the worst possible time. And but the reality, I think, with SparkToro is I don't even see anyone enter our field. And I think that's because everyone believes it's too small. No venture capitalist looks at SparkToro and says, oh, that nice little $2 million a year business, let's go disrupt that field. They don't care. And that's the beautiful thing. This is the amazing part about businesses where you think you could, you know, very reasonably build a $2 to $20 or even $50 million a year business. Venture capital is going to stay far away from them. If they don't think there's a $1 billion opportunity, $100 million a year opportunity for hopefully a few companies in that sector, they're not going to invest. And so those small markets are absolutely beautiful for entrepreneurs who are looking to build something that is great instead of big. And I would encourage founders who are looking at SparkToro style, you know, businesses or snack bar style businesses to pursue those sort of mini markets, right? Small to medium-sized markets are absolutely outstanding. There's 100 times more of them than there are
big markets. That's what I was going to ask. You think there's a lot of these opportunities?
Oh my God. I mean, there's probably, the number is probably literally tens to hundreds of thousands of times more, you know, $20 million a year opportunities than there are $200 million a year opportunities. It's not a linear scale at all. I don't think anyone in economics would argue that it is. And this is, you know, this is true because of geography. It's true because of field size. It's true because of, you know, hey, interior designers in Los Angeles really need a this, and ones in New York need a that. And there's only a few things that they both need, or, you know, that every interior designer around the country needs. And so if you can build a business that targets these fields, right, there's a lot of spend. There's a lot of rich people in New York and LA want their houses designed, right? And so I just think the quantity of business opportunities there is completely overlooked. And that also makes competition way easier, right? Entering those markets, serving that small group of people really well, hyper-targeting, marketing to those people is far cheaper. Cost of customer acquisition is going to be cheaper. Networking in that field is going to be easier. Advertising in that field is going to be less expensive. Onboarding those people and keeping them because there's less competition. All those things are just made simpler. Building a small team is easier than building a big team because you don't have to hire and manage as many people. Contracting and outsourcing is easier.
What about the 0 to 1 of it? Because, you know, the one thing about the venture world is, and obviously it's hard to raise and all that stuff, but at least there's a chance that if you can tell a sharp enough story, get into YC or whatever, maybe you raise $500,000 or $1 million and you get to pay yourself a salary, you know, whatever. And
that's,
you know, try. You do this, nobody's going to fund you. So like, how hard is it to just go those first few years?
Yeah, you have exactly hit on it, Pablo. I think the biggest problem in the, whatever you want to call these, like small giants or indie companies, a lot of venture capitalists like to use the pejorative term lifestyle business.
Yeah. It's a good lifestyle, by the way. It's a great lifestyle.
Yeah, right. It's meant to be demeaning, right? It's meant to be like, oh, you're adorable. Like, run along with your little lifestyle business. When you want to play with the big kids, like, come talk to me and do something serious. And
But it's funny that it's demeaning because, like, I'll tell you, like, just even the word, it's like, yeah, I want, like, you're actually doing it for the lifestyle. Like, you actually want that lifestyle. So it's like, wait a second. Anyways.
I'll tell you the way SparkToro did it and Snack Bar is doing it. And then, you know, you can tell me what you think, but I think it's fairly functional, which is in 2018, we SparkToro, right? Casey and I, with essentially an idea and a piece of paper, raised $1.3 million from 35 angel investors. They put in between $25,000 and $100,000 each. Last year, we repaid them their $1.3 million. And now every couple of years, we hope to make a dividend payment to them of between, let's say, 10 and 30% of the amount that they put in. And at the end of the company, you know, at some point in the company, we'll probably sell it. Maybe for some reason it'll go out of business or whatever. But by that time, I hope they've gotten 3 to 4 times their money. And they've gotten that in dividend payments. So we basically are using the profits of the business because the only way that Casey and I can get paid more than our salary is to make a dividend payment. When we get paid, they get paid. And it's a really, really nice, low risk kind of way to run a business. You know, even at our, you know, sort of scariest months. So for folks who don't know, the previous version of SparkToro was very dependent on Twitter data. We had a relationship with Twitter's API team and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, when Elon bought it, obviously, you know, everything fell apart. We had to rebuild the product entirely based on new data sources. Very expensive, very time consuming, whatever. But even in our worst months, we were still adding tens of thousands of dollars to the balance sheet in terms of profit, right? So it's like it's a low risk kind of business. It's not a high growth kind of business.
Sure.
We're growing like, you know, 20% year over year.
Investor perspective, you're thinking, okay, like the upside's lower, but there has to be materially less risk. Like the odds that you fail in a year have to be not zero, but let's say close to zero. You know,
if I were building a portfolio approach to this, 7 out of 10 companies have to get to profitability, right? Maybe even 8. And I think the venture mindset is like, well, no, startups will never have those odds. And my view is, well, that is because the culture of startups is grow fast or die trying and enter huge markets where there's lots of other people who are going to enter those markets. There's going to be one winner for a bunch of losers. You're going to basically spend in order to try and get growth
for
fast.
Sure. I think if you take TAM out of the equation, a lot of optionality opens up and risk, you know, goes down dramatically that you won't get 1 to 10 million in revenue. It's because you're unwilling to go after markets unless you see a possibility of them being billion-dollar markets. And even then, when you're in one and you think it's one, you got to double, triple, quadruple down to make sure you're the winner. Yeah, all that stuff dials up risk for sure.
And I think that there's a risk-focused mindset, right? Like as a venture entrepreneur, I think I was probably in the much lower risk than most bucket, right? I just have a mentality around keeping a sane balance sheet and making sure that income is similar to expenses. Whereas, you know, my friend Dharmesh and Brian from HubSpot, right? Were like, they were very venture investor, or very venture entrepreneur.
And it worked for them, obviously. So yeah.
We are happy to lose whatever, $4 million on our annual event because we know that it really builds a lot of brand in the thousands of people who come to that event. And I had this like, what are you talking about? Like, we make sure MarsCon is break even or better every year. You know, like, that's insane. But maybe, you know, clearly their thing worked, but most of the time it doesn't. And so I think there's a fundamental shift. So what my goal is I want to see not only SparkToro do well, hopefully Snackbar do well. There's a few other companies who fundraised using SparkToro's documents. We open sourced our docs so anyone can go and use them to
what
fundraise.
What was that? Tell me just quickly, like you told me how it would play out, but is there a valuation implied or like what's the structure of that agreement?
We used a pre-money of $4 million and a post of 5.3. So our investors own a little over 25% of the business, right around 25% of the business. And we have essentially they own units in an LLC, although a friend of mine just fundraised for his business using the SparkToro docs and did it with a C Corp. So it's at your option what you want to do. Both, by the way, qualify for QSBS, the Qualified Small Business Stock Exemption, which means that the first $10 million of, you know, earnings that you make on a sale of your units or sale of your stock is tax-free. So that's very compelling for a lot of investors too. And the valuation is flexible, right? So I think that because of my reputation and network, my valuation was higher.
I think so, yeah.
I talked to, you know, there was a couple of guys, I think they were in Atlanta. They raised using the SparkToro docs a few years ago. Their valuation was like $2 million and they raised $600,000 or something. So, you know, kind of a different, depends on who you are and where you are and what you're building, network, all that kind of stuff. But you could raise $50,000 on a $200,000 valuation company.
And how long did it take you to get profitable?
We were pretty good at that. You know, one of the things we did early on, Pablo, is while Casey was building the product for the first year, I was out there like basically building our email list, people who wanted the product that we were building. And so when we launched, we had maybe 15, 16,000 people on that list, possibly a little bit more. And we were profitable 7 months after launch.
That's awesome. That's great.
So break even profitable, right?
Sure.
And Casey and I's salaries were lower. There's in the docs, there's a built-in thing, again, sort of protecting investors and also encouraging founders, which is that our salaries were capped to the Seattle software engineer average until we repaid our investors their $1.3 million. At which point our salaries could be 2x the Seattle software engineer average.
Got it. Okay. That's helpful. You know, you mentioned with Moz, and it sounds like maybe with this one, like you spent quite a bit of time, let's say, building an audience before, you know, launching the product, building community. I think that's a skill set of yours, but is that something you would recommend like generally to founders? Like, you think that approach still works today?
I think it is a huge risk mitigation tactic. Right? Because in the process of doing that, you're going to do two things. One, you're going to mitigate the risk that at launch, nobody wants the thing you've built and that the cost of customer acquisition is too high. And the second thing you're going to do is you're going to acquire incredible market knowledge that will help you design and build a much better product. And so I cannot encourage people enough to, you know, become sort of experts in the field that they're in, build an audience through a variety of strategies. You know, at Moz, it was an SEO and content flywheel. With SparkToro, it was almost all PR and social media marketing. This friend of mine is building his strategy almost exclusively on niche media in the sector that he's in, and awareness through that, and then some content which may in the future rank in search engines, but is pretty challenging. That's a much more challenging task than it used to be. Every author does this. My wife Geraldine just launched If You Can't Take the Heat, right? That came out like a few weeks ago, and her entire strategy was based around essentially social media audience, podcasts, you know, some video interviews, some newsletters in her field, and it became a bestseller week one, thanks to those sources and support that she had kind of built up over years and years of audience building.
This is one I'm actually just selfishly interested. What was the process like of writing Lost and Founder? Like, how much was it harder than you thought it'd be, easier, to take you a long time, and just everything around publishing a book? I mean, it's so different than starting a company. Just wondering what that process is like.
Yeah. So I wrote a couple other books, but they were like SEO manuals, you know, educational stuff for like O'Reilly and Wiley, which are very different than writing for the big five publishers. So Penguin Random House ended up buying Lost and Founder, which was very exciting, and the advance was great and all that kind of stuff. But the process itself was essentially I pitched publishers in New York with an outline. Classic, like if you imagine what the 1970s Woody Allen movie where you go to New York and like talk to all these publishers and sit around a desk with people, it's not that dissimilar from that. Wow. And then my agent ran an auction for the book, and Penguin Random House did a preempt, which means that they said, we don't want you shopping it around. We want you to just sign with us right away. And we liked the offer, so we did that. I loved working with my editor.
Was that a function of just the interest in the book, or did you also have, because you have obviously like a big following on Twitter, LinkedIn, like how much was it, you know, those two things I'm sure played in, but it was the second
I would
one.
Say they played in more than the book.
Okay.
And unfortunately for a lot of authors right now, in nonfiction in particular, fiction is a little different. Fiction there, it's a little more speculative, take a chance, hits driven, whatever. But nonfiction is very much, how big is your audience? Geraldine and I like to joke that before she went and pitched her book, I should have just bought her 100,000 more Twitter followers, right? Because, you know, Elon lets fake followers flourish. So like, why not just buy a bunch of fake accounts, and then you look great to the publisher. So if anyone's listening and they're an author, I'd be like, yeah, just go on Fiverr and maybe bump up your social media numbers. Like, it's kind of sketch, and you'll probably lose them over the next few months, but it's helpful for those conversations.
<That's smart. laughs>
And they're not, you know, they're not super sophisticated about how they look at it. But I was going to say the process itself of writing was very familiar to me because I've been blogging for, you know, decades now. But the intensity was pretty high. So it was like a lot of writing. I wrote the first six chapters of the initial version of Lost and Founder, submitted them to my editor at Penguin. And she was like, this is not the right book. We got to throw this out and start over.
Wow.
And I remember being extremely frustrated that we couldn't have identified that from the outline, and you know that I had done all this work. But we ended up making what I think was a much better.
Oh, was it great? Yeah, it was a great book. Did you do it full time for that period, or is it kind of on the side?
It was on the side. It was kind of in lieu of blogging. If you look at that year of my blog posts on Moz, essentially I was still filming the video series, which was like an hour every week or whatever, but the blog post kind of trickled to nothing, and I did almost all my publishing or all my writing for the book.
And then let me ask this other question, which I don't know if you'll have ready-made answers for, but one thing I've noticed in general from repeat founders, and I had this myself, is you go through it, you know very little, you take all these punches to the face, and at some point during that you're like, wow, if I was restarting right now, like it would be so much easier, right? Because I would know this, I would know that, whatever. And obviously there was a lot of lessons like in your book, and some of it, that is true. Like there's always parts that are easier. I guess the question is like, which parts were you wrong on? Like which parts were surprising where you're like, wow, I really thought this was going to be easier, and it actually turns out it's almost just as hard.
You mean for SparkToro after I'd learned the lessons of Moz?
Correct, yeah.
I think product building and product market fit I don't even believe that there is like one product market fit. I think it's more of a scale, right? You are a better or worse fit.
Definitely
than,
spectrum, I would agree.
Yeah, spectrum, right? So improving along that spectrum, I think not made easier by doing it multiple times. And that's very frustrating. And part of that, I think, can be luck, right? It's kind of, I think Moz was a very lucky bet. Like we hit a market at a time where there was tremendous need and nobody else liked that market. And everybody in 2006 thought SEO was spam, and they kept believing that for another 10 years. And it took forever for sort of a mature community of people to think that SEO was a real practice, to think that Google was going to become the behemoth that it became. And so we had a huge advantage there. And we knew our audience kind of better than other people did. With SparkToro, I think it's been a challenge in that the thing that we help people do, audience research, is not a thing people are assigned to do very often. Like most companies don't try and figure out, oh, which podcast do my customers listen to, and what videos they watch on YouTube, and which channels they subscribe to, what subreddits are they on, and which sources of media do they consume, what email newsletters are they subscribing to, all that kind of stuff. I think that's crucial. I think that is absolutely amazing. I think most marketers I talk to are like, oh, that would be so useful to know, but it's not part of their job description, and it's not part of their tactical day-to-day work. And so getting people to like adopt it as a practice has been really hard. And then I think with Snack Bar, is the game going to be fun? Is it going to be deeply fun and addictive and enjoyable to play and rewarding? And that is going to be a huge challenge. And I think, I have no experience in that field, so I am taking a huge gamble. And I think the only thing that I've gotten much better at is I think I'm much better at identifying and recruiting extraordinary talent who can do those things, right? So like I think our game designer, who has a, history of like Just Dance and The Squad and Assassin's Creed. He was the lead game designer for Assassin's Creed and a bunch of other games. I'm like, this guy can do that. I believe in you. I know you can do it. And, our lead developer, Miriam's worked on a bunch of amazing games. Francesco's worked on a bunch of TV shows for like Netflix and BBC. I'm like, yeah, you guys are going to do an amazing job at this. But it's knock on wood. I'm sure I'm going to learn things there that are tough and challenging. And that field, the shitty thing, Pablo, about shipping anything like a book or a television show or a movie or a video game is it's not like software as a service where you iterate and, can keep selling it month over month. Like it's got to pop day one.
That's right. You've built it and will they come sort of thing. But it's, you've said kind of product market fit, and I take what you said as meaning like at the end of the day, like building something people love, delivering like great value, that's just never easy. It's just
never
not
easy.
Like, and it's not the other thing I'd read, which I thought really resonated with me at least, is like a lot of things are kind of gameable. I mean, fundraising is a bit of a game. You can get better at fundraising, even hiring, like convincing people to join you, these sort of things. Product market fit is just not gameable. Like you actually have to do the thing, right? And so, yeah, it doesn't get it. I'm sure there's pieces that get easier, but it doesn't actually get that much easier the second or third time around.
Yeah, I think there's elements of it that get much easier. For example, speed of iteration.
Yes,
I think founders can get way better at testing and learning from the feedback that they get from people, from networking, right? Building, like we talked about earlier, building an audience of people who care about the problem that you're solving, that is a skill you can get way better at. And that's something, that I pride myself on, that I think I can be good at and try and help a lot of other people with that. Obviously, SparkToro is built to do that. But I think that fundamental, taking all those insights and learnings and turning them into a product that delights human beings and makes them, solves their problems, makes them happy, brings them joy, brings them entertainment or education, solves, thorny, tactical, pain in the ass things that other things can't solve for them. There's no shortcut. No shortcut.
Awesome. Well, Rand, this has been an amazing, amazing episode. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure, Pablo. Thanks for having me.
You just listened to the whole episode. And let me ask you something. How much did it cost you? Oh, right. It was free. How many ads did you have to listen to? Oh, right. None. So guess what? You owe me. So click follow, write a review, and you'll be helping not just me, but other founders. Because every time you do that, the show continues to move up the rankings and more founders discover it.